friends, welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? And as you may have noticed, this is actually our first episode of 2022, and we're very hyped to be back. It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
But we're also here with none other than the author of the much hyped and much anticipated book, Brown Girls, Daphne Palasi Andriadis.
You're here. We're so happy to have
Yay.
You.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast and for the first episode of 2022. This is really a treat.
It is a treat for us, I'm telling you. What a way to begin our podcasting year. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm happy. Things have been busy here in the U.S. You know, the book came out 3 weeks ago here, but I have a little bit of a breather this week, and I'm just prepping for Brown Girls' release in the U.K. in like a week and a half. So lots of excitement and joy all around.
By the time this episode comes out, we are living in that future.
We are
in the time when Brown Girls is out in the UK. So that's very exciting for everyone involved. So where are you right now? Where are you broadcasting from?
I am broadcasting from Brooklyn at the moment.
Very nice. Well, greetings from London to New York. Shall we begin?
Let's dive in, because we have about 10 questions we want to ask. I'm so excited to discuss this book with you, because not to be an absolute brown noser, but I absolutely loved it.
Same.
I loved it so much. It is such a joy.
Oh, thank you.
So where did it come from? What was the spark that started Brown Girls?
Yeah, I started writing what would eventually become Brown Girls in 2017, and I was actually an MFA student, a graduate student here in New York City. I was in the second year of my MFA program, and I had really struggled in my first year, and so I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in the program, if it was worth it, if I needed a degree to write. It's an expensive degree. All of these different things that that I was thinking of and going through at the moment. But I decided to continue the program, thankfully. And in my second year, I happened to have an incredible creative writing professor who just totally changed my approach at the time. And I think just really helped me feel a lot more free on the page and free to do whatever the hell I wanted. And this teacher is also a writer. Her name is Elisa Chappelle. She founded this literary organization here in the US called Tin House. And Elisa is just a person who is so fierce and just really held us to high standards and really pushed me, I think, as a writer. And so one day in class in the fall, I remember that she mentioned this quote that just really resonated with me at the time. And I mean, she said a lot of great things as a teacher, but she quoted Toni Morrison. And the Toni Morrison quote was, if there's a book that you want to read, but it has not been written yet, then you must be the one to write it. And that just stuck with me, because I thought, what is the book that I am hungry to read and that I haven't really seen yet? And I realized that what I wanted to read was this book set in Queens, New York, which is my hometown. It is incredibly vibrant, incredibly eclectic, one of the most ethnically and linguistically diverse places in the world. And then I also knew that I wanted to center women of color and immigrant daughters in this story. And then I guess the last thing I will say, too, about kind of the genesis behind the book and behind the idea for the book was that Elisa, my teacher then, also really, really encouraged us to just take risks. And I take risks in our work, and I really wanted to do something different than what I had been reading, what I had been studying. I wanted to not be afraid to like make strange choices in language or in structure. And I think, yeah, that's where some of those unconventional choices in the novel come from, telling the story from a chorus of women's voices, structuring it through vignettes, blurring poetry and prose, all of these different wonderful things.
I wish you could see the smile on my face. I'm like smiling so broadly.
Ah, yay!
And we're going to return to some questions relating to what you were just literally just saying, sure, like 30 seconds ago. But before that, I would love to know like how, so you kind of began writing it as part of your MFA, and now it's literally mm-hmm. like a published book in multiple countries. How has it changed or evolved since you started writing it, or has it not?
Ooh, that's a great question. I don't think I've been asked that question yet, which I love, because it makes me reflect. I guess a couple of things come to mind. The first is that the novel actually started off as a short story. So it changed a lot in form. It grew a lot in form and became this longer piece. In the piece evolving from a short story to a novel-length project, I just couldn't stop thinking about this world. I couldn't stop thinking about these characters and this voice. So it kept growing, I would say, as time went on. I worked a lot with my editor and different trusted readers even before I signed with my editor Marie in the States and also Kishani in London. I worked a lot with both of them on really, really trying to hone in on this we voice and capture both kind of like a collective perspective, but also be very, very, very specific about the individual voices within that collective. And that was always a challenge, but I'm really grateful to have had such sharp readers and editors.
So I'm going to jump, because you've just mentioned the first person plural, and that's something that I wanted to ask about specifically. Yeah. It's such an unusual narrative voice. So for listeners who maybe don't know what I mean by that, the first person plural is the we, the collective voice of multiple mm-hmm. characters speaking at once. What was it that drew you to that specifically? And did you ever rethink it, or did you stick to your guns?
Ooh, I love that. Yes, it's funny because I had, you know, as I mentioned, I had never, well, I had only written short stories before this, or the project started off as a short story, but prior to this, I had only written short stories, so I'd never attempted a novel. But when I started writing Brown Girls, I was just immediately drawn to using the we. And usually in my short stories, I might write it from the first person I, or the third person, and then like in revision, sometimes switch it and try other points of view to see if that brings out anything different in the work. But when I started writing Brown Girls, it was almost as if I was possessed or something, because I did not try anything else. It just felt intuitive, and it just felt perfect for this project. I'll be honest and say that even though I was drawn to using this we, I don't really think at first, in that very first draft, I understood that choice. I think that so Ooh. Much, yeah, I was drawn to it, but I didn't really understand why, and I didn't really understand, or I don't think I was able to articulate who the we was exactly. And I think that's really cool, because for me, so much of creating and so much of making art really does happen on an unconscious level. Like, there are so many things I just don't understand necessarily at first, until, you know, maybe conversations with readers, or in the revision process, or really just thinking about it, or having these kinds of wonderful discussions. But at first I was really like, I want to do something different. I want to use this we voice.
Well, we're glad you did, because I think that's definitely going to be something that people, respond to a lot. So although there is definitely like narrative flow in the book, it's mm-hmm. not a heavily plot-based book. Was that kind mm-hmm. of always the vision that you had for it, or is that maybe a product of it changing mm-hmm. from a shorter piece to a longer one?
Yes. Well, before I turned to writing fiction and trying my hand at it, I had actually studied poetry beforehand. I took several classes in university before deciding to focus on fiction in grad school. And I think that, studying poetry, like, first, before fiction, was just so formative in terms, like, for me as a writer, in terms of really, really thinking about language on that granular level, like every single verb, every single image, thinking about rhythm and musicality, and like how the prose flows and how it sounds. And I think that when I started writing fiction, I had a much more, I don't know, like, kind of rigid or traditional, I guess, approach, in that, like, I was just following the so-called rules of, like, there has to be a scene, there has to be, you know, one character whose life and psychology you kind of dive into. And for me, writing Brown Girls was just letting myself be free to think of different ways of making this project and making the story at least interesting to me, and not feeling confined to this is the quote unquote one way proper way of writing fiction. And so I just brought in, I think, my background in poetry, also in visual art, to write this project and to really experiment. And it was really, really fun for me.
I think it has that freshness of experimentation about it. And I just realized we haven't really nutshelled it for our listeners. So if you're listening and wondering what we mean by the kind of lack of plot but strong narrative, is that the book is telling the chronological life and experiences of a collective group of brown girls in Queens. So with that in mind, I'd love to know, it's written, it reads chronologically, so from childhood right the way through to death. Did you write it chronologically, or in that spirit of experimentation, did you kind of write the bits that came to you as the spirit moved you?
Yes. I think both, to be honest. If that's possible. So this is a project that I was working on and off for 4 or 4.5 years. And I would start it and stop it to work on other essays or read my my other friend's work or short stories, or I was just too tired and busy with various jobs that I was doing at that point in time over the years. But yes, I think that the impulse to follow these characters chronologically over time was certainly there. The first few pages that I handed in to early readers were actually just of the characters in childhood. And I thought, oh, I've only written short stories. This must just be a short story. And my readers, annoyingly but rightfully, were like, you know, I think this could be something longer. There's more to this. And that annoyed me because I was like, no, can't you just take it for what it is? Like, it's just, if I say it's a short story, take it for the 15 or 20 pages that it is. But they were 100% right when I look back on it. Because yeah, as time went on, like I said, I just couldn't stop thinking about what would happen if the characters aged, if they had children, if they had partners, if they traveled, if they left Queens, if they went back to the countries that their families had left a generation or two ago, what would it look like? So, those were the narrative questions for me. And for the most part, they were chronological. And the ending of the book, which, as you mentioned, kind of follows the characters into death, or into them thinking about mortality, faced with thinking about their own mortality. That was actually, I finished that part during the first wave of COVID. And
because that does kind of come into it, doesn't it? Like, we are burdened with the knowledge that COVID exists within the book. So that was very interesting. And it's interesting to know that it coincided, yes. You know, like, it was happening in the world as you were trying to figure out how to finish this book.
Yes, exactly. And I think in so many ways, writing the book over these past few years, with COVID included, the project was really just like a reflection and an artifact of everything going on at these different moments in my life and also in the world. So I think that's kind of cool to the project.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I'm so surprised that it's been something that you've been working on for so long, because obviously that final chapter is current, you know, it feels so fresh, like fresh off the press kind of thing. That's really surprising. I love it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's so interesting thinking about the idea, you know, what you're saying about having these... To someone who hasn't read the book, it may sound like a kind of strange proposition to have, you know, trying to have kind of specific experience, you know, going to different specific countries that are the places that the different brown girls are from, and to have that kind of specificity while also having quite a general... narrative. And that might sound like a kind of strange proposition to read, but like, it's so interesting and so like I can't really think of any other books like it. So and you mentioned at the beginning that Queens has an extraordinary kind of linguistic and cultural diversity, and that's definitely very, very explicitly kind of mentioned during the book. And did you kind of do much research to capture such a wide range of experiences, or was it just like knowledge that you had from your life?
Yes, well, I definitely drew from my own, you know, lived experiences, from my own memories, but at a certain point early on when I decided, okay, yeah, I want to keep writing about this world. I want to keep writing about queens. I want to keep thinking about how this we voice could encompass women of color across different diasporas to kind of highlight the solidarity and sisterhood, I think, that can and does exist in attempting and wanting to move beyond my own memories and my own experiences. One really fun part of my research process was actually reaching out to a handful of childhood friends and loved ones that I had grown up with, or we were best friends in school, and doing just very, very informal interviews with them. I had probably a list of, I don't know, 8 or 10 questions. And then I asked these very, very generous, like, supportive friends, you know, would it be okay if I interviewed you? I'm thinking of this project. It uses this we voice, and the we is primarily first and second generation immigrant daughters across different diasporas, I think. Can I interview you? And so all of my friends agreed, and they sent me emails, they sent me voice notes, and yeah, so these friends are, for example, I mean, my family is Filipino. I identify as Filipino American, but my friends are Haitian American, they are Dominican, they're Chinese, they are, where else are they from? Panamania, Bangladesh, all of these different, just diasporas. And so I asked them, some of my questions were like, what are sights, sounds, smells, songs, even, that you remember, like, growing up in Queens? What immediately comes to mind for you? And all of my friends described, different things from the neighborhood or from school, or from growing up in New York City. And then I also asked them questions like, what are things that you know, having grown up here in the West, in the States, that your parents don't know because they immigrated here, and it's a different experience? And then I asked them vice versa. What are things that, like, you think your parents know that you don't know and that you will probably never experience? I asked them, do you think there's a difference between dating someone who is a person of color versus dating someone who's not? If so, what are those differences? What are your experiences? So it was just a really, really fun and informative process to hear where my friends and I, where our experiences overlapped as immigrant daughters coming from these communities, where our experiences completely diverged and how they were different. So those interviews, I will say that their responses and everything they said, the different details that came to mind, did not make it into the book in any sort of parallel way, but they were really just a way to help me think about possible conflicts in the book, to think of this, like, atmosphere of Queens, and really try to think of the range of experiences within this unique voice. So, yeah, that was my research process.
That sounds like such good research.
Thank you.
And it really does show, like, in the texture of the work, like the broadness of Queens, and especially talk about things like smells and music, which are so personal, and yet in this like choral voice, individual experiences do kind of bubble up and then pop down and bubble up and pop down.
Yes, thank you.
Did you have, so what was your journey to publication like for this book? Because it's such an unusual book. How did you experience finding an agent and getting a publisher?
Ooh, yeah. I had been given advice by some of my teachers and mentors at school that I really, really took to heart, which was focus on the work and take your time with the work and on the manuscript that you are laboring on. Get it to a place where you are just like really, really happy with it, and you've revised it. You've thought about every single aspect of that project. And I really took that to heart too, because I thought, well, I don't feel comfortable submitting something, you know, to publishing professionals, agents, or editors that is kind of like, I think, is halfway there. And, you know, maybe that's just me. I think also there's like a perfectionism in there. But I think it's also like just wanting to put my best foot forward in my work and really have my work speak for itself and, stand on its own, I guess. So that was really my goal. I think that's why the project took so long. I mean, aside from like starting and stopping and like getting frustrated at the project and then like coming back to it, which is just natural, I think. But yeah, I was really just like, I really, really want to get it to a point, get Brown Girls to a point where I know that I am happy with it. And when I submit it to agents and those rejections come, I know that I've done, you know, it's not for lack of trying or lack of revision. Like I can stand by every single choice that I make. And it's probably not just, it's just not a good fit with that agent, you know?
Like you've done your bit and then it's up to them now.
Yes, right. So, yeah, that moment did come. When I felt ready to start submitting Brown Girls out to different agents whose authors that I just absolutely love. And that was a huge milestone for me at that moment in time in 2020, because I had been working toward that for so long, I think. So I submitted Brown Girls to probably five or six agents who were like dream agents for me. I got a couple of rejections. I got a couple of very, very nerve-wracking phone calls of like, let's talk about the project. And two offers for representation, which was just a dream come true at that moment in time. And even now, so my agent now in the U.S. at least, her name is Jin Ah, and she's with the Wiley Agency, which also has, you know, a branch there in the U.K., and I submitted to Jin, like I said, because I had been so enamored with her authors just for many, many years. Jin represents like Mary Gaitskill, Alexander Chi, Ling Ma, who
ooh,
else?
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So just amazing authors. So I had known of her and I had known of her authors. And then I also met Jin at a writer's conference, and we got to chat then briefly for 30 minutes. And then she said, you know, submit your work when you're ready. And this was back in 2019. And then I submitted Brown Girls to her in the summer of 2020. While we were still in lockdown, actually.
Wow, yeah.
Insane. And then we went out with the project to different editors that fall. So that's kind of the journey.
And here we are.
Yes.
So from your point of view, were there any kind of authors or books that influenced Brown Girls?
Absolutely. There are so many. Well, yes, I know that the choral we voice that's used in the book, you know, as you two said, it's not often seen in literature. But one book actually that was a model for me in thinking about the we and how, like, I wanted it to be this, like, very expansive and elastic point of view that could, like, contract to show the collective and then shrink to show an individual voice, and just do that, like, with so much grace and deftness, was this book, this novel that I read when I was probably 18 or 19, called The Buddha in the Attic, and it's by an American author named Julie Otsuka. It was published in 2011, I think, and Julie Otsuka actually has another novel coming out next month, and a third novel, and I think all three of her novels have been told through a we voice. Like, it's her thing. But anyway, with Buddha in the Attic, it basically follows, like, a group of Japanese picture brides who are coming over from Japan to San Francisco in the 1920s. And I just really, really loved how she handled the we and had it be so, like, expansive and graceful. So that was really one model for, like, thinking about the choral voice in Brown Girls. I turned to Milkman by Anna Burns, and also this book called Slumberland by the author Paul Beatty. I turned to two of those books to really, like, think about place and think about humor in Brown Girls. I think that there's a lot of painful and difficult things in the book. But there's also, like, a lot of humor, I hope, that comes across, and, like, playfulness and irreverence in the tone and in the language and the crazy shit the characters say or do or think. And so I just turned to, Anna Burns and Paul Beatty, also Zadie Smith, to really, like, capture that wryness in the text. Two poets who I really, really love that I think were also very formative to Brown Girls are these two poets. One called, her name is Claudia Rankin, and yes. she wrote, yes! Oh, you like the book too?
Yeah, love it.
Yes! Claudia Rankin, she wrote Citizen, which is also, like, told through, I guess I would call them vignettes. She also uses this interview process. And then the second poet whose work I just really, really admire, her name is Maggie Nelson, and she wrote Bluettes.
Love it, Maggie.
So I just adored and was so inspired by Bluettes and by Citizen. I just really loved how those authors were just so like free and so voracious in their work, and that like, yeah, their works are called, they're labeled as poetry, but I really see them as these hybrid, mm-hmm. hybrid texts. Like they have prose, they have poetry, they have elements of nonfiction because they use interviews. They draw from like philosophy and visual art and history and like social media. And then I thought, wow, that's so cool. Like, I want to do that. I want to be able to do that. I want to have the freedom and the courage to do that in my own work.
I like reading work like that, I guess, yeah. Someone who has a background in like poetry and short fiction. It like gives you permission to experiment in that way.
Yes, right? Like, absolutely.
So our next question, I think actually we've kind of covered it, because we were going to ask you if there are any other books that you would compare Brown Girls to. Mm-hmm. But unless there's anything else that you wanted to throw in, just more of a comparison. But otherwise, I feel like we kind of covered that.
Ooh.
If someone loved Brown Girls, what would you recommend they read next?
Ooh.
Me be a bookseller.
I know. Wow. Well, definitely, definitely all of those different, all of those poets. That I mentioned. Who else? Oh my gosh, I think I would not be a very good bookseller. I don't know how they do it.
No, I think it's a really hard question, because once you've listed your influences, like, it's such a unique book. Like, yes. I don't think I've read anything quite like it before. So I think I would definitely struggle if I was a bookseller in this position.
Agree.
Yes. Yeah.
So instead of recommending something that is a good follow-up to Brown Girls, what are you personally reading right now? Or what have you read recently that you'd love, that you'd like to tell us about?
Sure. I have been reading a couple of different things recently, which has just been... Oh, I miss it. It's just, you know, it's just been really, like... creatively filling. I've been so nervous about these different like book events and interviews and different like publicity things, wonderful publicity things. It's been really nice to like to come back to the fiction and to the stories. But there is a short story collection that I am reading at the moment. It's titled Manywhere by the author Morgan Thomas, and it just came out here in the States. It came out yesterday, actually, and Manywhere follows... it follows... I'm trying to think of how to describe it, too, because I haven't really read anything like it as well. But it centers queer and genderqueer... characters, many of whom are just like little known or forgotten historical figures, and a lot of the stories take place in the American South. So yeah, it's Morgan Thomas is just really, yeah, really smart, but also really playful. and I love to see it. I'm also reading this novel, but it really also feels like a novel in short stories, because every chapter is a different character's point of view and can stand alone. The novel is called How High We Go in the Dark by another author named Sequoia Nagamatsu. And yeah, it might be too close to home, but there's like an Arctic plague that has broken out in the future. So it has a lot of like really, really great like sci-fi elements to it. It reminds me a little of like
of Ted Chiang's work. I think Sequoia's book comes out in the UK. I don't know if it's in February as well. I can't remember.
Ooh,
but soon.
That's worth looking up then. Yeah, what was that one called again, sorry?
How High We Go in the Dark.
Okay, awesome. That sounds, as soon as you're talking about interconnected short stories, I'm very in.
I heard your little ears prick up. I sensed
you
it.
You did.
Yes. Yeah. And the crazy thing is, I know, I get it. Like, I know some people might be like, oh no, an Arctic plague. We're living in a plague. It's too close to home. I don't want to read it. But the crazy thing is, Sequoia wrote it, had been working on this book, I think, for like 10 years before the actual pandemic hit. So much of the book feels like prophetic in the way sci-fi sometimes, it's like a future that we're also living in the present moment. It's like, oh my gosh, yeah. How'd you know?
Makes me think of Severance by Ling Ma, which I just could not believe had been written pre-pandemic. That blew my mind.
Yes.
All right, well, I think that has covered everything.
I agree.
Oh my gosh, thank you for letting me chat your ear off.
No, it's so good. We love having an author that like is interesting, knows how to chat, like has interesting things to say. Like, we love a chatty author. So thank you so much. Everyone who listens to this episode is going to like the sound of Brown Girls. So if you are smart enough to be listening on the day that the episode comes out, we're running a little giveaway on the What Page Are You On Twitter account, where we've got 3 copies that could be yours. And we're going to close the giveaway at midnight on Saturday, the 5th of February. So you've only got like the day that the episode comes out and the next day to enter. So yeah, we recommend you head to the Twitter account and do that. Daphne, thank you so, so much for taking the time out of your day to chat to us. You have been a joy, and we're so hyped for everyone in the UK to get to read your excellent book.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really, really fun, and I also cannot wait for the book to be out in the UK. It's so exciting.
So exciting. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. We'll see you next time, friends. Bye.